Hi, friends, and welcome to the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro. This is episode number 182, and today we're going to be talking about something that's near and dear to me, known as the Animal Fit Jump Test. But before we do so, I would like to say, hey, thank you so much for being here, for being a listener, and I'd also like to ask you to reach out to us. You can let us know what you think of the show, whether you agree or not with some of the things that we cover. This is definitely First Amendment territory. Let us know how you're doing, if you've applied some things that we've discussed, or also if you just have questions that are burning that you'd like to see addressed, either directly as a question or as a podcast topic. By all means, do so. And in the show notes, you'll find the links where, you know, you can get to me on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, or directly at contact@thelifetimeathlete.com. So that's my first request, shall we say. And I'd also like to say hello and good morning, find out what's up with our wonderful and amazing co-host, PK.
What's up, John?
I've got stories.
Do you? You've got stories? Well, lay them on me.
Yeah, I had an amazing experience yesterday. And it's basically this, that I got the opportunity to work with an 85-year-old Lifetime athlete.
Really? Okay. Talk to me. How did that come about?
That's wonderful. So this is a lady who is active and healthy and vibrant and sharp and all, you know, lucid, all those things. And she is a hiker and an avid fisher person. You know, not the kind of fishing that some people might have in their mind, but this is someone who climbs down the bank and wades the river fly fishing and does that for hours on end at the age of 85. And so I'm like, wow, what an honor.
That's amazing.
What a great honor to get a chance to work with this lady. And, you know, she found me through our circles. And here's the interesting part about this. We did an online coaching injury resolution consult. And that was, in addition to being wild, just that here's this wonderful 85-year-old person who's certainly inspiring me, I also thought, huh, isn't it so nice to see a person of that generation who has no issues with tech and the utilization of this model, which I find in the context that I use it to be so effective and so simple.
Absolutely. So, John, that's just, well, first of all, an incredible woman. If that's her age and her activity level, and obviously just a dynamic individual, if she's, you know, hopping onto this, you know, relatively forward thinking model of yours, and then, you know, just getting after it.
Indeed. And a lot of thoughts went through my mind. And one of them, you know, once I got past the, gosh, you know, look at this, individual and what she's doing, and also how receptive she was to how I'm doing most of my things these days. And so then I started thinking, well, you know, I see when I'm talking about doing online coaching or physical therapy type work, mm-hmm. I see it split three ways in terms of the reception that I get from people on that.
What are the three?
Well, okay. First of all, you get people like this person. And stereotypically, we might assume that this is going to be more common in a younger generation. But it's like, oh, okay, this is one way that we can do things these days. And, you know, it's pretty simple tech. You know, you just open your app and you have your meeting and you communicate across the screen and you get results. And that's about a third of the people that I, you know, engage with. They're the early adopters, or maybe that's not even fair to say anymore. They're in the mode.
Right. Okay.
Then there's another third who will say, that's not for me. You got to see me. I got to be in the same room with you. I think you might need to touch me. And then I, you know, I say things like, well, I mean, I, first of all, having proximity to humans and human touch is valuable and it's important, but I don't need to do it. You want me to do it. And I'm not saying that in a condescending manner at all. But that's, you know, this preconceived notion that for the type of consultation that I'm doing, I almost never need to do that. And, you know, people think so strongly that somehow their experience is going to be better. Well, and I assure them, say, well, here's the thing, though, I can see you. And I'm not in a hurry. It costs less. You have my undivided attention. I listen. And that has value. But again, so those people, Matt, I want to go somewhere and be touched. And especially if it's...
John, before we move on from there, I mean, I think that some of that is, it's certainly the people, but I think it's some of the physical therapist, the legend of the physical therapist. I mean, it's perpetuated by some of the brick and mortar physical therapy techniques where I need you to come in so I can get my hands on you. The therapist saying that, I feel like.
Yeah. And I think I hesitate to use words like master clinician, but you know, as you evolve, and I've talked to some colleagues about this, your need to do that becomes less and less. Now, I'm not saying it totally goes away, because it does not, but that's one of the reasons why I still run some Black Ops concierge service, because I enjoy getting with people, and there are circumstances where it's just doggone necessary. And so, you know, if I say, first of all, okay, look, if you got a bone sticking out of you, you got blood coming out of you, that's not an online consult. You need immediate medical attention. Please do so. Also, if you've had a surgery and your wounds are still draining and you're in a very dependent or passive mode, online's not the best for you. You need to go and get the kind of care that's most effective. But at some point, either those folks, or particularly the people that have these, you know, just nagging chronic problems, questions, I'm going to say it actually works best to do it online because of the efficiency as well as effectiveness. So, you know, kind of rambling, what happens in that second tier of people that I was mentioning that say, nope, I want to go somewhere and have that experience. Many of them get back to me and say, hey, can I get in with you online and do this? And I say, why, what happened? And they say, well, I went to that place and I went to see Dr. So-and-so, doctor of blank, you know, medical doctor, doctor of osteopathy, doctor of physical therapy, doctor of chiropractic, the D word, you know, somebody called D word. So I went there and, you know, the appointment only lasted about 5 minutes and they didn't seem like they wanted to listen to me. And I didn't really have a satisfying experience, and it went through insurance, but because I have a big deductible, it all went out of pocket and it was really expensive and I'm super bummed out.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about that many times, both on and off the pod. I get you.
Yeah. So this happens. And so I'm like, yeah, okay, I get that. And so, you know, the point would be, when a clinician gets to the point where they know how to cue and how to communicate, which is so critical, you can take a person through various movement assessments across the screen. Most of the table tests that we do can be, you know, duplicated just by the individual with good instruction in their home or office. And I personally have gone away. I don't use provocative tests as much as I used to. So a provocative test is when you just reproduce somebody's pain, you know, and there's a psychological component to that. It's like, oh, okay, you know, this guy really knows where I hurt. I found that I can get the information without hurting people. So that stuff is very interesting to me. And then lastly, there's just the people that it's just not for them. It's not going to happen. That's fine. That's a waste of my time and energy to try to convince someone whose mindset is quite rigid.
Absolutely. Well, that's fascinating, man. And I'm just pumped to hear that story about the woman that you started working with, and keep us, I guess, informed as to how that shakes out.
Yes. And it's just wonderful stuff. So today, now, I don't even know how this relates. It doesn't matter, because we're going to be talking about the animal fit jump test. And I, first of all, I would say jumping is, so it's also something that's very important to me because I see it as a valuable skill for humans. It's a necessary athletic attribute. The act of jumping and landing also bestows many health and even fitness and safety benefits into our bodies. So training for jumping is, you know, that's something that I like to scale and do with most of my clients and myself. But I've also come up with a way that you can use jumping safely to assess, you know, quite effectively your body type and athletic tendencies or proclivities, shall we say.
Absolutely. And this is sort of under the Animal Fit umbrella. New book came out last week.
Yeah. Animal Fit, you know, unleash your inner beast and unlock your athletic potential. Well, you know, I, in doing that, I have a number of things in the book where a person can go through and we've talked about them before, but you can assess your skeleton and your mobility and your muscle fibers. But when you start getting into these, movement problem solving opportunities, your body will reveal the movement pattern that it will self-select to accomplish a task. And almost invariably, it will pick the one that matches your body type, or as we like to say in Animal Fit terms, your inner beast. And that can give you just a world of self-knowledge and also indications for training.
I love that. I love, yeah, that's the 1-2 punch right there. Self-knowledge and then how to apply the training. Well, how do we get started doing this jump test?
So we get started by me saying that for any person, you know, for whom it is appropriate for them to jump, we're going to do the test this way. They're going to take a stable chair or a weight bench or like a plyo box, whatever they have available, and they're going to put it somewhere that's safe to jump upon it. And then without, you know, again, assuming they're warmed up and they're ready to go, without any other instruction or thinking about it, we just say, hey, jump onto the thing, the box, the bench, the chair. That's the test. Now, if a person says, that level, there's reasons why that's not appropriate for me, I'm going to say this, then by all means, don't do that. Just think about it. So now I'm going to say, okay, since you can't do the jump and see what kind of jumping technique you're going to use, just almost assume you're about to do it and think about which one of the three that we're going to go over you would pick. And most of the time, you know, you can still figure it out without even doing the jump itself.
Okay. I'm right there with you. I'm imagining doing it myself. So I'm right in the mind of someone who would be going through this.
Okay. So what I think I'll do is I'll mention that for this jump, there are three types of strategies that one would use. Again, recognizing there's all sorts of, you know, jumps and bounds and skips and hops that we use in training. But for this test, the body automatically picks one of the three. There are no other options. And I'm also going to say that all humans have the ability within them to use all of these methods. But because of our body types, 51% of the time or better, we're going to prefer one. We're going to choose one. It's going to be our dominant movement problem-solving strategy or pattern in this mechanism.
That absolutely makes sense. So the body's going to pick one of these three, and it's going to, if we're doing the test, it's going to defer to the one that is the most compatible with their body type.
Yeah, it just does it because of experience and motor programming and what's most efficient and effective. So, you know, these brilliant beasts within us really know what to do. So I know you're waiting for me to describe the three jumps very briefly. So first of all, we have what's called a CMJ or counter movement jump. And we're going to go over that one. We're going to have the short approach impulse jump. And then we're going to have the long approach run up jump. And I think we can very easily go through what are the characteristics of each jump, and then what are the kinds of athletes that will select these and why.
I love it. Well, let's get started there with that first one, the CMJ.
Okay, so a counter movement. So basically all that means is if we're going to jump up, first we do a lowering of the body, the center of mass, as the counter movement. So that's kind of, you know, you think of how spring works. And so that's a counter movement jump. Well, it is a relatively deep movement when a person is going to jump onto a chair using a counter movement jump. So in other words, they'll stand in front of this bench or box, and then you'll see them lower down, bending their knees, maybe as much as 90 degrees. They're going to hinge forward, lean into it. Arms are going to go down and back. And that is what the counter movement looks like. So it's relatively deep. Also, this type of athlete is going to use a relatively speaking, slow lowering or eccentric phase. So as they get down into that counter movement, you know, you can see them do it, and they're not moving as rapidly as they're going to on the way up. So they're getting ready. Usually as well, they're going to be squared up. So in other words, 2 feet facing, you know, nice and even. That's typical with the CMJ. And almost always, it's a two-foot takeoff.
That makes sense. It's actually very visually sort of aligned with, you know, what you can see for this type of jump.
Yeah. And so then we start thinking about those muscle contractions, which we've discussed on the show previously. There's the big three: concentric when muscles shorten, isometric when there is no movement in change in muscle length or movement at the joint, and then eccentric when the muscle is lengthening. So this counter movement jump typically has an emphasis on the concentric phase.
Okay. What's that mean?
So that means that once they get down in that counter movement, a lot of the muscles that are going to be the prime movers have been lengthened. And then it's the shortening or concentric contraction of those muscles, you know, like the quads in particular, that creates the anti-gravity force or jump.
Okay, interesting. God, so in that way, the quads have been stretched like a rubber band, and the jump comes from them contracting back together?
Yeah, it's almost like, if you think about it, this is the athlete who pushes up against gravity.
Ooh, and, I like that. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And so they are what we often call a force-dependent athlete. They're capable of generating high amounts of concentric contraction and muscle force. So most of the time, these athletes, they're going to be your muscular athletes, mm-hmm. and they're going to use this. Obviously, this counter movement has a deep knee bend, and so it's considered a knee dominant or quadriceps muscle dominant jumping strategy. So the counter movement jump has all those things in it.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. It's very visually sort of clear, John.
Yeah. And so that's the territory of the bear. So the bear in animal fit terms is, again, you're usually big. You can be a small bear, but strong person. And so a person who has, bigger bones usually, but also quite a bit of muscle mass, and especially in those legs. So that's a bear. And of course, the bear's cousins, which would be the otter, that's the slimmed down bear, or the badger, which is the revved up bear.
Got it. I love this. And so, okay, when we kick this off, we said, all right, now the first step is self-awareness. And then the second is how to apply training based on that self-awareness. So let's say we've got a listener that says, John, I am a bear. What you described is how I would jump up on that chair, that block. What does that mean for me in terms of my self-awareness and then subsequently the training that may be best suited for me?
Yeah. So when you see that counter movement jump, it's very geyser-like in the bear. And so it uses what I call a build and blast methodology. So they get down in there and they build energy, and then eventually it erupts and they blast into the air. That tells you that your body is very good at these concentric motions. And so you're going to be very push oriented in a lot of your movements, like say acceleration and running, for example. Those are people that can use a very steep shin angle or 45 degree incline body driving out to accelerate, whether that's court field sports or track. Also, these are people that are going to do very well with heavy resistance training. They're going to respond well to it, and they're going to be very proficient at it. So we know those strengths of the athlete that uses counter movement jumps. And then we also say, well, also we want to balance that athlete out. So we make sure that we, in their training, you know, put in a few other things to keep them able to use this primary attribute without having other deficiencies that can become problematic.
Absolutely. And, you know, as someone who has a little bit of bear in me, I can really identify with what you both, you said in terms of leaning into the strengths, but then also just some things to be awareness in terms of, we won't call them weaknesses, just considerations, you know?
Oh, precisely. And so we do that animal fit jump test, and then we learn something. Oh, okay. That's one of the three options. That's the counter movement jump. Now, if you go to the next one, at least in the order that I have them.
Sure.
We were talking about the short approach impulse jump. And okay. So it almost looks exactly like it sounds, you know, instead of being squared up and solid and then bending down and jumping, there's an approach or some movement towards this box bench or chair. And there's a much more rapid conversion where, you know, you almost see an impulse and boing, very springy, like this athlete bounces up onto the object.
Got it. So would this be, when you say short approach, would this be like one step? Or would it be like, you know, like a drop step in basketball or two steps? What do you mean by short?
Yeah, I don't think that you can, or you have to be too specific, but just a couple steps, you know, maybe one, two, maybe three. It could be, you know, just a quick hop. It could be a short broad jump, you know, anything that kind of really what it allows the body to do is, get into the air and then hit the ground harder.
Oh, got it. Okay. Perfect. Okay. Thanks. Continue. That helps.
So this type of jump, when you see a person do it, it's more shallow. Their flexion angles at the knee and the hip and ankle won't be as deep as those who do the counter movement. They're going to bend, yes, just not as overtly deep as that first group. And that's because they're using what's known as the stretch shortening cycle in muscle contraction more rapidly. So they're going to throw that force into their body and really, you know, the spring snaps back much more quickly because we have less of this kind of like geyser boiling up. It's more, much more spring-like in this presentation.
Yeah, those words are great. Spring snap. That is definitely what I'm seeing in my mind as I'm imagining what you're describing.
Yeah. And most of the time in this elastic athlete, their approach will be somewhat asymmetrical. They don't need to square up. In fact, coming in at an angle with a little rotation allows them to twist or wind their fascia and their tendons a bit. And so they get more elastic recoil or rebound from not being squared up.
Now, John, this is something that you and I have touched on a couple times, really just in casual conversation. And I find it so fascinating because, you know, I think that we've talked about it in the context of basketball where, you know, maybe that you can imagine a ball and it's out in front of you. But when they're winding up, the ball goes, say, to the left. And as they jump, it crosses the chest and up to the right. That is so fascinating because it's something before you had described it, I'd never connected, although it's an experience that it just as a human athlete, you say, oh, that does make sense, even though I'd never put the pieces together before.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously there's potentially three planes of motion, but you can argue that everything is a rotation. And so these are just people who use rotation most effectively amongst humans because they understand how to be shapeshifters and, get that springiness, which is partly, and you could look at any number of other materials, you know, like if you pull it or push on it, it's got some amount of natural elasticity, but if you twist it, you've magnified that.
Right. Oh, awesome. Well, carry on, keep going. I'm seeing what you're describing in my mind.
Yeah. And it's fun to do this because we do have to go through and kind of build that layer cake to make it make sense. So again, it's a fairly short approach. Now here's the thing. Elastic athletes are fairly versatile. So you won't see them always be chained, if you will, to using a 2 foot takeoff. They can select 1 or 2 feet to take off from, depending on what the context requires. So again, they're just, these are the, these bouncy athletes that can do that.
Got it. Making sense.
So here's the real trick, the secret, if you will. When we talked about concentric muscle contractions for counter movements, now this ability to do the impulse and to be elastic is, it's really the territory, the property of isometric stiffness. So the athlete is able to isometrically contract and basically temporarily stiffen, you know, muscles, tendons, and even bones so that they can harness Newton's third law, so that that stiffened body now transfers energy most effectively. There's no need to generate it because we're transferring it, and there's, you know, we're not going to leak it either. So it goes into the ground, and then that stiffened body receives the ground reaction force back, and then away they go. And so the isometric is king for the elastic jumper.
Very good. And so if we're talking about the counter movement being knee dominant, what does that mean for this, you know, for the short approach impulse?
Yeah, you can almost know that this is ankle dominant. So that calf muscle, the Achilles tendon, the plantar fascia, the feet, all of those things work together to create the stiffness to get the bounce. And so it's, you know, that's the area of initial ground contact. And so if we're hitting that with a slop, slap, flop noodle, you know, that's not, we don't get elastic transfer, we get collapse. And so you can see that why it's critical to be there. And you'll see this in those athletes too. They tend to be, they tend to have short ground contact times when they're moving around, jumping, running, et cetera, because stiffness transfers fast. And they're just like bouncy looking critters.
Right. So would this be, you hear it talked about kind of in like basketball player, you know, NBA draft terms where they have got a good second bounce. So this would be, you know, like not the first one, but the second one. This would be an obviously we're not talking about this in the test, but that would be the kind of athlete that would have that ability because it would just be happen quickly using the calf dominant, the foot, and just with a execution of that.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, if you look at the bear being counter movement jump, they're good for one jump, but you know, they're not as good at landing and doing another one. Whereas this type of impulse jump is the panther, and the panther's cousins, which would be the bobcat and the wolverine. And so those are those athletes, they have a little more elastic stiffness potential. And the strategy that they use, which will make total sense, is what I call load and explode.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very visual description.
Love it. And I, you know, I worked on those terms for years, you know, just studying the literature and watching athletes and stumbling along and coming up with ideas that were stupid and didn't work. And then now I have this thing, which I think is just a golden egg.
Oh, absolutely. It is. And again, so let's talk about, we've got listeners, they're saying, hey, John, you just described how I would do that. I'm a panther in this context. What does it mean for my training?
Ah, so we know then that this elasticity is going to be a strength. And so we want to go to that in training. So these are kind of athletes that do well with plyometrics and jumping exercises and, you know, more of your interval training types of things. One thing we know about these athletes is they're very impressive in their abilities, but they also tend to have, I don't want to say fragility because that's not quite the true word, but both from a CNS perspective and also just a muscle fiber perspective, these are very fast twitch wired people, the highest amount. And so they need recovery in their training. For the training to be most effective, we need to actually get into some of those higher intensities to bring out this elasticity, but we got to give them rest breaks. And so, you know, a marathon jog or a CrossFit grind, it is not really the ideal way to train a panther to bring out their best.
John, I absolutely love how you describe that there, that because of the fast twitch, there needs to be intensity, but then there also needs to be the recovery. I think that's a way better way to describe it. And to, if you have some Panther in you, to sort of embody and absorb your own experience, than saying, oh, fragility or some, you know, opportunity for, you know, weakness, in other words. So it kind of reminds me of something that you brought up last time we were training about, I think it was Olympic sprinters, where you said after a big sprint, they would take as many as 10 or 15 minutes in between. Is now I'm remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So in sprint training, we have different terms, and sometimes it does confusing. So there's with the longer reps that an athlete might use, they use terms like speed endurance or special endurance one, special endurance two. And again, the nomenclature varies from one expert to the next. But generally speaking, if you're running, let's say a strong long rep, so you're running at 90%+, maybe 95% of maximum effort or maximum velocity, and then you're extending that out as, you know, trying to increase your ability to hold speed at distance, which is the goal of that type of training, there's a high lactate production. And so, you know, lactic acid production, which is converted to lactate and hydrogen ions. But nonetheless, that has a shutting down phenomenon, which we've all experienced. Well, if you go that hard for that long, let's say it's, you know, it's like some of the longer methodologies, like 400 meter runners training repeat 600s, which was a Clyde Hart model. You've got to take those long rests, because that's the only way you can, you know, obviously bring the heart rate back down, but that happens after a few minutes. But it's just, it's metabolically clearing this lactate, which is produced by the fast twitch fibers. And we need to be starting that next rep relatively fresh, or we're not training speed anymore. We're training, you know, mental toughness, conditioning. There's a place for that, but it's not going to make an athlete faster.
Right. And just the idea of a 10-minute rest in between is something that I believe a professional athlete would be like, that makes sense. But for, you know, maybe just, you know, those of us who aren't pros, we'd say that seems like so long.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's funny because having done some of this myself, If and you get those people that, you know, they don't understand training yet, or their bodies, or maybe they haven't had good coaching, but they're getting a little antsy after just a couple minutes and they want to go again. And it's because they didn't go hard enough the first time. Because if you push yourself the way it's required, you're almost dreading the next rep, and you want every one of those seconds before you have to do it again.
Well, John, I love that. That was such a great, and I know we shifted over to sprints, you know, got away from jumps for a brief moment there. We've got 70 listeners. I'm sure they're tracking with us, but all right, well, let's talk about the third, which I believe you described the type of jump is a run up.
Yeah. And in fact, what you said previously makes total sense, because there's an extremely strong correlation between jumping and sprint speed. So you thank you for doing that. But now, you know, we've gone through, okay, we've got that kind of beastly bear counter movement. We've got the springy cat impulse. Now we've got that long run up. And here's how I do this with folks. I say, this is actually the person that it's very, very easy for them to figure out who they are. Because if you look at that box, bench, or chair that you're tasked to jump up onto, and immediately you're thinking, I'm backing up. I got to take a run at it. Okay, there you go. You're going to use a run up technique.
And you can absolutely see that too. It would happen without even thinking, right?
Exactly. Yep.
If you started the person 2 steps from the chair, and you said, jump up on this, and what they did was they backed up a few, then you got it. And I love that, because that's such a, it's such a response. It requires no thinking, just performing the activity, but we get insight into what type of a jumper you are.
Yeah.
So what does that mean if you're that run-up person?
Well, this is cool, because this is probably the most, I think, you know, just a unique application of physics. So the CNS has learned, okay, this is how this body that I'm in is going to complete that task, jumping the most efficiently. So you back up, you take a run at it. Well, what that does is it converts horizontal velocity to vertical displacement.
Could you elaborate just a little bit? I think I know what you're saying, but I want to make sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like you get up some momentum and you're rolling along, and then you try to contain most of that momentum, and then you sort of, you know, through this jump, you know, you convert it so you can go up with and bring that horizontal speed or velocity that you had with you. So that does actually kind of bleed in a little bit and help you to get up onto this object.
Absolutely. I'm imagining a high jump in what you just kind of like described there. That's what came into my mind.
Yeah. And if I would try to, and I like that you give me these opportunities to explain. So the high jump is a unique event because all of the best high jumpers they have some amount of, you know, like cat-like abilities within them. And so they're using the impulse, but they're adding on to it the run-up. So that's really the only way that, say, like the ideal human can get up over that bar is, well, okay, let's use the impulse, which we're very good at, and it's a single foot takeoff, but they run up to do it. And then also, you know, in your horizontal jumps, you know, the long jump and the triple jump, again, most of those people are very impulse oriented, but then they'll layer on to that the run up to get even more distance. Whereas the and to be fair,
sure,
those people, the high jumpers and the long jumpers, if you told them to jump up onto the chair, they're going to take option two. They'll just do a quick impulse because they've got bounce. They don't need to run up. But it's the people that either don't have the strength of the bear or the springs of the panther that have to choose the run up, because now here's where it gets really cool. They can't generate the energy. They can't transfer the energy. So they have to steer it. So that's, they get the energy going in their system, and then they use mechanisms to minimize leakage.
Oh, that absolutely makes sense. Keep going.
So a run-up oriented athlete is going to go straight ahead. They're going to come right at it. They're going to use a long approach. And they could, I mean, I've seen people, I've said, hey, I want you to jump up on that chair. And I've seen them back up 20 steps. So it's really cool to watch. It's always a 1 foot takeoff, because if you stop and try to take off 2 feet, now you're using the other strategies. And again, they're really chained to needing to keep that momentum going and just go off 1 foot and just steer or bend those force vectors. So this energy containment is the ability of the eccentric contraction, or the body to use eccentric contractions most effectively. So that's when force is coming in and your muscles are lengthening to handle that force. And the run-up athlete is good at doing that, sort of contract here and there and keep some of that energy in the system. So then you can divert it out, you know, through the foot and changing the direction that the body's going in. So that's really like fascinating to me to see people who do very well. I mean, I've seen people, they can jump up and land on a file cabinet, you know, using this technique. And so it's not that these people can't jump. It's just that they are using the method that works best for their body. And although I wouldn't recommend jumping on file cabinets for anybody, you know, safety features there, but you know, So the counter movement bear was knee dominant. The impulse oriented panther was ankle dominant. Well, now this is hip dominant when we're running up. And the reason is, if you're flying along and you've got to handle force and then, you know, bend it upwards, you got to use the strongest area in your body. That's the glute muscles. And so that's why we see this. And this is really your longer, lankier athletes most of the time. So they're going to be the coyotes. And then, you know, the cousins there are the wolf and the raccoon. And this is a strategy that I have termed lope and launch.
Nice. So what does that mean? Again, we're applying this to training. You know, we've got someone saying, hey, I am in that coyote family. How do I apply this lope and launch How do I tailor my training? What do I look out for?
Yeah, so I think we recognize this is usually someone who does well with duration, volume, endurance-oriented training. They don't necessarily have the same characteristics of the other athletes, but in this group, we probably want to make sure we're sprinkling in some of the type of training that we did to the bear and to the panther to keep this coyote well balanced.
Well, I like that. Okay. And in what way? Keep it balanced.
Yeah. Like, and I think one of the best examples would be you take like a person who, you know, just does long distance athletics, you know, running, cycling. Mm-hmm. There's probably other things that aren't coming to my mind right now, but those two in particular, if they do only that long enough, they start to look stiff, slow, weak, and fragile, and only capable of moving in a straight line. And I'm not trying to be mean here because this is just what happens. Sure. So by balancing them out, say, okay, let's get you under a little bit of load and create some concentric strength. That's going to help you to keep doing the things you love. And also let's use a little bit of, you know, speed and plyometric training where it's appropriate to keep your elasticity and your stiffness in, which will improve your running form in this case, or multi-directional movement ability in any of those cases.
I love it. It actually is. It's very easy to make the connections between the description of the movement, the jumping, and then the appropriate training.
Yeah, and the amazing thing why I was calling this a golden egg earlier is you can get all this from one jump.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, just one, just a single jump.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you're going to get the personalities. The person said, I want to try it again. And, you know, or, well, I don't know which one I'd use. And I say, well, no, you're thinking too much, because if just said, hey, jump on that chair, you'd do it.
That's right. We're not thinking, we're doing. And then what you can learn from that. Now, again, what I think is kind of fascinating, my takeaway is that this is just one of the tests that the animal fit methodology gives to the reader to have a more informed self-awareness. And I think that it's so in that regard, and this is a plug for Animal Fit, if you're listening out there, you haven't got one yet, this is just one way to understand yourself better and then just reap all the bennies of that understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you happen to follow the Lifetime Athlete on Instagram, you'll see these things featured from time to time. You know, different athletes of different ages doing jumps, among other things. And then also, if you just want to see what we just spoke about, there's a nice little video on the Lifetime Athlete YouTube channel. You can also access it through one of the articles at thelifetimeathlete.com, just to help you through what's in the book. And so that, like you said, PK, it's only one thing that's in there, but the jump test is probably, I think, one of the greatest self-assessments that we have available for understanding and optimizing our inner beast.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, listeners, for being with us, and PK as well. If you need any more information, I think at the beginning of the show, I talked about how you can get at me. That'll be in the show notes. Love to hear from you. Thanks again.
Adios, everyone.